Hi, my name is John.
And my name's Chris.
And this is Stay on Target.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Stay on Target. We are your hosts.
You can find us online at stayontargetpodcast.com.
That's right. So, John.
This week, we are reviewing Hunger Games Mockingjay. And I just want to throw this out there. Yeah, part one. I just want to throw this out there. Last week, I listened to the podcast as it printed down on things, and we got the name wrong 99% of the time.
Why do we keep saying it? Wait.
We kept saying Catching Fire.
Did we really?
We really did. At the very beginning of the episode, I want to say we said Catching Fire, and we meant Mockingjay, and at the end, we finally caught it. Like, after the entire episode went by and we'd referenced it a couple times, we actually caught it, and I made fun of you for saying it wrong whenever I think I was the very first one that said it wrong. So I apologize, Chris, for making fun of you whenever it was all my fault, because I set the tone.
I spent all week
for the misnaming.
In shame. Over that. Dude, not really.
Everyone, like, as you walk into a room, ooh, everyone gives you, like, the stink eye. Was that what it was? No, it was the crazy eye.
Was it the crazy eye or lazy eye?
The lazy eye. Was it the lazy eye?
Lazy eye.
The lazy eye.
Five Goes West.
Eye.
The lazy eye.
Yeah.
That is an amazing movie, and it makes me want to watch it now.
Dude, that was on Netflix for a while.
What? Is
so,
it still there?
I don't know, but I know the original was on there. So American Tale was on there.
Yeah.
Or no, yeah, it was American Tale was on
yes,
there. But then there was American Tale, Fievel Goes West was also on there for a while. I watched them both while it was on there. I'm not sure if it's still there, but if it is, everyone should go and check this out.
If it is, I'm going to go watch it right now.
Somewhere out there.
Stop
good stuff.
So, this week we're reviewing Hunger Games, and we just got done seeing it.
Yep.
It was good.
Yeah, it was good.
But you have to wait for a review.
And with a review, we'll obviously have our normal spoiler-free section at the beginning, and then we'll do a spoiler countdown and spoil the heck out of it.
Yep. So, John, what have you been up to this week?
Okay, so it's not been that long since the last podcast we did, and we did the last one, I think it came out on Friday morning, and we're sitting here, you know, just
Tuesday,
about a half a week or so. But I had some family in town over the weekend, and so here's the situation. Like, they were coming in town, so, you know, it was my in-laws, it was Catherine's parents, and so they came into town and they were going to do the Christmas shopping for us and give us Christmas gifts and things.
Yes.
So I under the whole weekend, like, we're doing Christmas shopping and they give me things, like, so I'm picking out these things, and at the end of the weekend, I was just assuming that they would, like, give them to us, like, wrap them up and give them to us, and watch us unwrap them and things.
Yeah.
But at the end of the weekend, they wrapped them up, gave them to us, and said, like, hey, there you go. Wait till Christmas. Like, it was this underlying joke whole weekend.
So you have to wait until Christmas to
open
these things?
The 30-some-odd days until Christmas before
I'm opening
these.
You're telling me that Super Smash Brothers
for
3DS
is
sitting downstairs?
Unused.
I mean,
it's really funny. Like,
how's anyone gonna know?
It was this. That's what they were saying. Like, they were gonna. They were like, oh, there's gonna be ways. And so it's like, I wonder if they've booby trapped the presents or something. Like,
you open one and purple ink gets all over your hand.
There's just a mouse trap inside. Snap.
Gosh.
No, it was just this underlying joke the whole time of like, we're gonna make you wait.
One's filled with tear gas.
But then it was true.
Man,
just funny. It was awesome.
I find your torturous waiting hilarious.
It's amusing, isn't it?
Yeah. Not because of any ill will, but this is a very strange scenario that I don't know that I ever would have envisioned in my head.
That's what I was saying. But Catherine, like, the whole time, Catherine's like, no, they're serious. And I'm like, there's no way. Like, there's no way. And she's like, no, I think they're 100% serious. And I was like, I didn't buy it until the last day and they left. And I was like, oh.
Baffling me.
Oh, they were serious.
So I
hilarious,
man.
What about your weekend? I'm sorry, I threw you off with my story.
I spent the weekend. Actually, I didn't have any work to do this weekend, which was amazing. This is the first time in like a month. So
yeah, that's great.
I actually had some downtime, and we caught up on a lot of television. So we watched a lot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is still as hilarious.
That's still
as ever.
Going strong, dude. Going strong.
We caught up on The Walking Dead, which is doing really well so far.
Don't spoil me, Chris.
I'm not going to spoil you. We're two episodes away from the mid-season finale, though. Like,
that's pretty intense.
That's it kind of boggles my mind.
Well, how many episodes are we in on Arrow? Are we like 6 or 7 in on Arrow, I think, at this point?
Yeah. I mean, we'll be 8 Okay. You know, so I don't know. It just, it doesn't seem like we've been watching TV for that long. You know what I mean? Like,
it's true.
I don't know if it's just
time's
been this,
flying, dude.
Yeah. Like we're
well,
almost,
we're almost done with November. Like we've only got 1 week left in November movie month, for podcasts.
This is true. I mean, it's almost Thanksgiving. It's crazy. It's just weird. It just feels weird. So caught up on that, started getting caught up on New Girl. So like did a lot of catching up.
Dude. So there's a lot of that catching up that you've been doing.
Yes.
I almost made a Catching Fire thing, but this wasn't Catching Fire.
It wasn't.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's basically been it. Been doing some more Destiny. There was an update.
But you didn't get the raid in last week.
Didn't get the raid in. I think we're going to try the hard raid tonight. Hey, maybe we should Twitch stream it.
Ooh,
no one will hear this.
No, nobody's going to. Everybody's going to like get online like the night they hear this and then... Oh, it already happened.
Yeah,
though.
So maybe if you happen to catch us on the Twitch stream, congratulations.
Here's what you need to do. Build a time machine. Go back in time. Yeah. Tell your previous self to go watch our Twitch stream, mm-hmm. And you'll
you
have some good time.
You go through an interstellar wormhole.
And tell yourself via a bookcase in your house.
You can only go forward by looking at the past.
This is maybe some spoilers. I'm not sure.
that was a line... From the commercial, Lincoln commercials he did.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's a spoiler for that.
Dude, that's crazy.
It's not a spoiler for Interstellar.
No spoilers for Interstellar, though.
No.
Wow. Dude,
so anyway.
That sends me back to Interstellar like 2 weeks ago, and now I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, stop that. Stop. We'll move on.
Get sucked in that perpetual Christopher Nolan memory loop there.
Yeah, actually, man, this is something I'll post.
I dream about it. Inception.
Something I'll post on the podcast is, I guess today... Wired teamed up with Christopher Nolan to release a prequel comic, 7-page prequel comic to Interstellar that focuses on man, whatever his first name was, the guy who...
Matthew McConaughey.
Hang on. Without spoilers, I can't really tell you, but it's a prequel comic.
Okay, cool. So basically, don't read the prequel comic first before
no,
you go see the movie. Like you're sitting there in the theaters waiting for it to start for the half hour beforehand or whatever.
Yeah.
Don't read the comic at that point.
Yeah.
Wait until after. Trust us.
So anyway, but it's pretty cool. I'll post it in the podcast
StanTargetPodcast.com.
Yes. And so yeah. That's there.
But Chris, we've got to get to this Mockingjay review.
Okay.
But first, the pick of the week.
The pick of the week.
Okay, so Chris, I don't know what your pick of the week is. This seems to always happen whenever we do pick of the week. Is
I
that
know yours.
One of us reveals their pick.
That's true.
And the other one doesn't.
That's true.
Like whoever says it first will go, "What's your pick?" And then, like, because we'll say, "Oh, we'll do pick of the week this week," and we'll go, "Oh, I got a pick." And then, "What is it?" And then one person tells, and the other person doesn't tell.
Yeah.
So, do you want to go first and reveal the big secret, or would you like me to go first?
No, let me go first.
Okay.
Okay. A lot of times, as you know, I can't think of a pick of the week. I will literally lay on the floor.
That's true.
And
Chris does a lot of laying on the floor.
Rack my brain, trying to figure out what I'm picking this week. This week, okay.
Usually it sounds like this. I don't know what my pick is this week. John, what's my pick of the week? That's usually what it sounds like. It's good.
This is true. Last week, I was going to pick. If we'd done pick of the week, I was going to pick the same pick of the week. Okay.
Okay.
But this week, it's even better.
So it's like an update.
It's an update. Update pick of the week that never got picked. South Park. The last two episodes have been amazing.
Yeah?
Last week's episode focused on freemium games, and it was a good topic.
That's awesome.
It was funny. It was very, very in-depth. It kind of poked holes in the whole freemium game thing for sure.
That's fun, man.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
And Trey and Matt, like, they have experience with that, with the game development cycles and things like that, because they brought out their own video game.
It's not freemium. But
it's not freemium.
Yes. So that yes, they have experience with that, and it was very. Like everyone kind of love. You have a love-hate relationship with these games on your phone that like make you pay money to boost your building or whatever. I don't know. Like anyway, poked a lot of holes in that. Now this week's episode took things to another level. Now I'm not going to say that this week's episode was It was probably my favorite episode of South Park in a very long time. I like South Park. I watch every episode. I think, you know, it's still innovative. It's still really funny.
Yeah.
They're still able to, you know, like, they're still great at what they do.
Super current. Like, they always bring in cool current events.
This one played off of the Oculus Rift.
Nice.
All right. And it started there. Okay.
Nice.
And then it goes into an entirely different realm. Like, at one point, you are so confused and you don't know what's happening that it just blows your mind. Okay. You're just like, I don't understand. And about the same time you're saying, I don't understand, like, one of the characters comes on and it's like, I don't understand. And it's like, it doesn't matter. And yes. So the end of this episode makes it all worth it, because honestly, like, I'm not gonna say this is the most gut-bustingly funny episode ever.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, it, the laughs,
but just from a narrative standpoint,
the laughs are few and far between as far as, like, you know, I'm actually laughing out loud.
Gotcha.
Okay. There are clever jokes in there, but it's more on taking you on this ride, and where it ends up was one of the most satisfying places.
Nice.
I think I rewound it like 4 times. And press play again.
Dude, I love those episodes. And see, to me, comedy is some of the best at that type of thing, where by the time you get to the payoff, it's just been this constant buildup. And while it may have been funny, you know, it wasn't just super funny, but then you get to the payoff and it can pay you off in an emotional way, unlike any other type of genre almost. I think there was a couple episodes of Community that were kind of like that, that end up, you know, converging storylines. And I think comedy is so good at it because it doesn't have to make logical sense all the time.
Yeah.
Because a character doesn't have to abide by the rules of the world all the time.
Right.
Because, you know, comedy, it's all about doing the unexpected. But you can do unexpected things in ridiculous ways.
Well, I mean, you know, you think about, you know, like, both two of my favorite shows I previously mentioned, New Girl and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. They both do that. Like, those are ridiculous shows. You outline the plot of each one of these shows, and it just is outrageous. It's like, this does not happen in real life. But you watch it and you accept it as real because these characters are grounded in reality, and it makes it really, really funny.
Right.
This took it to another level in terms of... So you have the rules in the show, and then you introduce virtual reality into it with the Oculus Rift. That's whenever it gets really crazy.
That's awesome.
That's all I'll say. Like, you just need to go watch it. You can watch it, I think, for free. I think it's up on South Park Studios for 3 weeks.
Okay.
And then after that, it goes to Hulu. So if you have a Hulu subscription, like, they have the exclusive rights to broadcast or to stream every single episode
of
South Park.
That's all the seasons, too.
All the seasons. But... it's for free for like 3 weeks up on southparkstudios.com. The episode is called Grounded Vindaloop.
So, something that I've been told about this season of South Park is, and I haven't been keeping up with it, is that it's serialized, like, as in, like, each episode is kind of connected the way that TV kind of is these days. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to play off of these long jokes that they have rolling.
That's been something, like, they've never done this before. Like, you know, sometimes...
Well, there was one season, I think, where one of the characters stayed dead for the whole season. But other than that, all the changes or anything that happens within one episode remains there.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we've had things, you know, we would reference back to them before, but it's never been, like, where... Like, you would introduce something for no reason in one episode, and then it shows up and it's like the main plot line of the next episode. You know, like, and I mean, we had callbacks to other episodes, and I'm sure there were teasers for the next episode in this one. You know, like, you really don't see it until it happens the next week. You're like, oh, they referenced that last week, which is really cool because they've never done that before. And honestly, I hope that we're building to something spectacular for the season finale, because... You know, like, the past few years, they've been getting better at planning out their season finales. You know, like, they're known for kind of spur of the moment, like, really current things, which they're still doing that. But I think they're taking more of a long approach to these seasons now and kind of doing some arcs over the seasons, which is really cool. Like, last season, whenever their video game was supposed to come out, we had a 3-part Black Friday console war episode, and it's like they made it really like Game of Thrones, and so it was really relevant there. It was about the PS4 versus the Xbox One, which was releasing about the same time. Their game was supposed to come out at the same time, you know, so it was really, really relevant. And this year, I hope that they have something kind of like playing off of what they're building on right now.
That's awesome, dude. That's awesome.
What is your pick of the week?
My pick this week is something that you told me to download. Like, we were sitting around playing some board games, you know, like you do sometimes. And you said, here's a game that you need to download, John. You said, A Dark Room. Okay. And so I Googled it. You were like, hey, it's free. And it wasn't free. It was like a dollar. So I was just like, oh, that's way too much, and I didn't buy it. No, I totally bought it, because a dollar is very little in the grand scheme. And so I bought it, and it is almost like a text-based adventure thing.
Yeah.
With like hot buttons that you push in order to do various things. It reminds, so it's like it's an adventure.
It reminds me kind of like of Zork, only with more of an interface.
Right, as in like a pre-planned Zork, like, yeah, where you're not typing in like, hey, I'm gonna use my hero satchel and pull out the whatever.
Yeah.
You have like pre-programmed commands that you can press.
Yeah.
But basically you get this village started, mm-hmm, and there's this mystery about like, hey, what is, I don't, you know, why do I not remember anything? Mm-hmm. And it's like, then you end up eventually going out and adventuring into the woods. Mm-hmm. And okay, so I will say this, like, there was a moment whenever all of your villagers that you've gotten over time or, mm-hmm, whatever, and you're getting these resources and, mm-hmm, things from them, they all of a sudden, you like, you start like, you have this internal dialogue that pops up on the screen every once in a while.
Yeah.
It urges you into the woods. It urges you to find a compass. It urges you to make supplies, well, and things.
It also feels like it could be some kind of external force.
Right. Like
telling you these things.
Putting on your conscience. And then eventually, like, I overworked my people, apparently, and it goes, they are slaves. And they're slaves! And you're just like, man, am I a terrible person?
You avoided that.
I did. I reset my game.
Yeah.
Like, I looked up online without like looking up spoilers or whatever. I was like, is it possible for them not to be slaves?
Yeah.
And it is. It's possible.
For you
to finish the game, you just have to keep everything in balance.
Oh, my gosh.
To where nobody, no one group of people is overworked.
That sounds awful.
And what is terrible is whenever a thief comes in, mm, and they're stealing resources from you.
Yeah.
So that they can't, the workers can't turn around enough,
yeah,
in order to make up for what the thief is stealing.
Right.
And so it's just incredibly difficult to not make them become like your slaves or, yeah, whatever. But this game is super fun. Like, it's really fun. And, yeah, I haven't gotten incredibly far. Like, I haven't gotten to the end. Apparently there is an end, and, yeah, you can get to the end story or whatever. Haven't gotten there yet, but I've gone out, done some adventuring, hit some caves, hit some houses.
Mm-hmm. So I've played this for hours.
Have you completed it?
I have not completed it. I don't even know. Like, right now,
I just wonder what the end of the line looks like on this.
Like, there's a map that you can like uncover whenever you explore, and I've uncovered several parts of the map. Like, you can kind of find different pieces of the map. I've found several locations where there's. Have you found the?
You don't have to like spoil it. Go ahead.
You want me to spoil it?
Yeah, go
ahead.
There's
an alien borehole.
Oh.
And you get the alien metals.
Wait. So is potentially is this. This voice, this inner dialogue, is this something of alien origin?
I don't know. Like,
are you an alien? Is that why you don't remember anything before you wake up in the dark room?
I don't know. Because, like, have you gotten to the outposts?
I have not.
I mean, you go to the outpost, and there's like, hey, this is an abandoned, you know, school building. And you go inside, and you can rummage through the place, and there's like, sometimes you get ambushed, somebody behind a door, a bum with with the bottle smashes you over the head or something. You get too far out. And there are, like, anywhere that you're on, that there's not a path. And the path, like, the way this is visually laid out is hilarious. So, like,
oh, yeah,
the path
just little numbers.
X's.
Yeah.
And then, like, I think the land around you is, like, is letter P or something like that.
Yes.
Like, and the outposts are a letter O. So, like, and you're in
houses are H.
What is the at symbol? What is that actually called? The ampersand?
Yes.
No, wait, no. That's and.
No, the at symbol.
I guess it's the at symbol. So that's what you are going around.
Right.
You get too far out into the what they're calling the desert, and I think it's just like a slash or something like that. And snipers start shooting at you,
dude. What is this?
I don't and if you don't have the correct ammo and guns, you cannot get past them.
Like, I mean, I guess, do you have to get past them and that's the end of the line?
I really
I just wonder, where does the end game here, you know?
I don't know, because, you know, like, there's parts of the map I haven't uncovered yet, but I can't get far enough away in order, like, this is the thing, I just, like, the most recent thing that happened was, I went out and grabbed, there was another alien borehole out in the middle of the desert, so I killed one sniper, got to the alien borehole, like, got some medals, and then there was something else out there, too, I can't remember exactly, a house or something with some stuff in it, and I was traveling back, and I was like, okay, if I can just get out of this desert, like I'm home free, I'm out of bullets, and my health is pretty low, but I get shot by a sniper.
Oh,
like
gosh.
Immediately, like the last step that I took in the desert, like I get shot by a sniper.
Oh man.
And so like the problem is, whenever you die, all your resources go away,
right?
So I don't know, dude, like it's very interesting. That was actually a few days ago, and I was just kind of like, I'll just put it down and think about this for a while.
Going through those things in your head where it's like, is it worth it? Is it truly worth
like,
it?
I'd played it for like a couple hours at that point, and I'd get shot with more resources out in the desert.
Oh, man.
And the only, like right now, my people can't, like, you know, you don't know what the next step is. You don't know what the next upgrade right. for your village is.
Right.
You know, so at one point, I think you can, I found a steel sword before I got a steel factory, you know?
Right.
So now well, I can manufacture them.
You have to find the resources so you can basically reverse engineer them in your village and start making them.
Right. But so I found guns and I found bullets, but I haven't yet been given the ability to actually build them and create them. So like if I lose them, like I just did out yeah. in the desert, I've lost them now.
Wow. You
know? So I don't know if there's a point, like if there is a point at which I can manufacture my own gun and bullet, like that was the
there's
problem. I ran
be.
Out of bullets. If I can manufacture my own stuff, like I could actually like go and explore, but you know, you don't know. You just keep your village going until something happens.
Try
know?
To kick that ball down the line a little bit more.
Well, there's like
dude, the beasts that come out of the forest.
Yeah,
and stuff.
They come like wipe out half your population,
and then you can't like make any resources anymore.
Yeah, you get back from adventuring, and the fire's gone out, and the entire room's dark.
Your settlers have died of dysentery or something. You know, whatever.
Yeah,
that's actually
Oregon Trail.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's addictive.
It's very addictive, and. I will see. Well, I'll keep you updated if I get any farther than you, but it sounds like you're like way like light years ahead of where I am.
That's the thing though. Like I don't know if I'm going to pick it up. Like
you don't know if you're going to finish?
No, I will. It's just like right now I'm kind of like, all right, I got to take a break.
Of course.
You know,
of course. That's how it gets.
You work up to a point and you're just like, then you lose it all.
Then failure, you know, stares you in the face.
Yeah.
Well,
what do I have to lose anymore?
Speaking of potentially dystopian futures,
okay,
we should probably get on with the Mockingjay Part 1.
That's true.
Review.
Well, that's our pick of the week. I want to come up with a backstory for my guy in a dark room.
Dude, you should. So, like, you should come up with some huge, like, lore about him.
Yeah. I'll write it down.
You should write it down.
It'll be like fan fiction. So this week we saw Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1. Did I say it right?
You did say it right.
All
right. You said it correct.
This is the first part of the last book in the series. So like this
what
is
if
based
we
on
broke
this.
Our reviews into Part 1 and Part 2 of all these of a bunch of like stories and movies and things?
I don't like that at
It'd
all.
Be terrible, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So like this is the final book in the Hunger Games series. They broke it up into two movies a la
this is the trend.
Harry Potter.
Yep.
And did Twilight do that? Mm-hmm. And Hobbit was made one book made into three movies.
Just make it three. And then there's also, I mean, I guess Divergent, the Divergent series is doing it as
the
well.
The last book in that going to be two movies?
Apparently.
Oh, my goodness.
But
anyway.
It's just the thing. It's just the Hollywood trend to like stretch out these franchises into, you know, something. I don't know why the last book, though. It's like sometimes, like Catching Fire. The book Catching Fire, I would have liked to seen like Catching Fire as yeah. two movies maybe. That could have been cool.
I mean, I think it's easier to do it with the last movie because, you know, you do it with the first or the middle book and it's kind of like, oh man, come on guys. Like how long is this going to last? You know, like you have to maintain momentum. So you get everyone hooked and you've got all this momentum going and then you have like kind of a more slow burn going into the final film, you know. Launching right into it, I really like this movie, and like I think we've talked about before, I have the propensity to really like middle movies. So like we're talking like Harry Potter, the last two movies of Harry Potter, I like the first one a lot. Like that's whenever they're like out in the woods and they're like, there's a lot of talking. Yeah, but it feels really cool. You know, like I really like this one. I like Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
I really like middle movies.
Well, Desolation of Smaug.
We talked, that's whenever we talked about it. Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, yes, I love this movie. Like this movie was great. And you should definitely go see this movie. Spoilers for, I guess, later in the podcast, whenever I say the same exact thing, that you should go see this. But I did definitely feel like it was half of the story.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like there was a big payoff. Like if I were to say, from like step one all the way to the end of this film, you'd be like, where's the rest?
Well,
whereas Catching Fire, even Catching Fire, which is the middle book and the middle story, in this series, definitely has like a beginning and this ramp up and then a climax, like a peak.
Yeah.
As does the first book or as the first movie. But this one definitely didn't feel like it really had a major physical payoff. Maybe some emotional payoff.
Lots of emotional payoff. That's the point I was going to make, was like, no, we didn't have if you haven't read the books, you know, like, I'm going to skirt around a lot of things, try to.
Yeah, we're going to try not to spoil the last half of that third book.
Yeah,
so.
But like, there's no like major battle. There's a couple, not even really a good action scene, you know, like at the end. But there's a huge emotional payoff in various ways at
there
the
is.
End.
There is.
And so like this is more about, I think this book and even, or sorry, this movie, and even the first half of the last book was more of setting an emotional tone and mood and giving you context for why what happens next takes place.
Right.
Because honestly, thinking of everything that we have to get done in the last movie, it's just going to be like a full-on freight train.
We're just roller coaster ride, dude. You're just going to be holding on for dear life.
Yeah.
I will say, and I think we mentioned during the Catching Fire review back, I think it was last year, whenever we were sitting right here, this book is way more internalized than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking not only especially the first half of that last book.
The way it's written.
The way it's written, yes. It's very much internalized. And so something that I think was a flaw in the first Hunger Games movie, in that adaptation from the book, is that they didn't really try to take anything that was the internal dialogue and make it external. They didn't really show you anything. They never pulled back the curtain on anything.
Right.
You basically stuck with Katniss the whole first movie. Whereas in Catching Fire, the thing they did in a beautifully well done way is they took you out of it and put context to it.
Mm-hmm.
They had conversations between some of the overrunning characters that Katniss wasn't in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these, you know, kind of setups and payoffs from a global perspective, from a lot of the bad guys even. And so this movie continued with that.
Yeah.
It made a lot of the internal struggles that Katniss was having and gave them context, gave them something to point out in the world and say, that's why.
Yeah.
You know, that's why these people are reacting this way to her. That's why, you know, all of this stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And that's why it's a normal reaction for her to be this way.
Yeah.
So I think that from that perspective, this did an incredibly good job with communicating that emotional impact of, you know, what happened in this film. So
I really enjoyed, like, they expanded the visuals of this world and really, like, did a lot more world building now, like, than we have in the other two films. I mean, there's a lot of establishing things in the other two films, but, like, we see more pieces of more of the world in this one because we spend so much time in the other movies in the actual games, you know?
Right. Like, well, you have to, you know, and even those stories, like that was the main struggle was I like how this series got progressively larger.
Yeah.
The first one was all about just basically saving other people or whatever.
Yeah.
Then the second one was all about, you know, what am I going to do? It's a little bit bigger because you introduce the whole first half of Catching Fire where they're doing the world tour and Katniss is realizing there's more to this world than what she ever has realized.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, it becomes a fight for the entire world.
Yeah.
It becomes a struggle against these big social institutions and governments as opposed to being just an internal kind of me versus that person. So
there's always been something really appealing about this story, and it is funny, like how it kind of tricks you into like the story that you get in the first movie slash book is not the story you end up with at the end of the whole series, and kind of tricks you into getting involved in it, which is kind of like Katniss's story, where she's kind of tricked into getting involved in this whole thing.
That's true.
Which is a weird parallel.
And it's phenomenal, like the way that pays off. And I like how in this movie, there's a lot of stuff that is going on, and even in Catching Fire or whatever, that you just feel like you got caught up in. Katniss is definitely the perfect everyman, like is the perfect, yeah. Every man, every woman, whatever. But she's the perfect person for you to empathize with, mm-hmm. Because she's caught in this level of gray almost, where, you know, there's obviously, a worse of two evils, yeah. in this situation, but there's maybe never a clear, you know, clear good, yeah. almost. So,
something I really like about the movie is that Katniss is very relatable. Like she is, and every woman you can put yourself in her place. Whereas contrast that with the book, she's not so much that. No. We'll talk about that more in the spoilers, but
yeah.
Spoiler section. So I'll expand on that later. But in this, you know, in the movie, like I really like the way that they've portrayed her, and I really like the way that. You can really feel emotional attachment to her. You can empathize with her in ways that I haven't before.
Right, right. And so in that way, it is. It's kind of changed a little bit of the source material. And I think that we called Catching Fire the best book to movie adaptation that I had probably experienced. But in this one, I almost think that even though they changed a lot of that, mm-hmm. I still feel like it was one of the best book to film adaptations. Yeah. Because, you know, if you'd done it as was on the page, it yeah. wouldn't have really translated to film necessarily.
But, right.
One thing I wanted to bring up, the music, dude.
Yes.
James Newton Howard did the mm-hmm. The score for this thing, and dude, it is just perfect.
Oh, yeah. There's several times whenever, like, the music, for various reasons, gives you chills, and you're just like, oh man, this is amazing,
dude. So good.
I really like their use of music, and in this movie, it's very intentional.
Yes,
and I really appreciate that.
And it wasn't ever, it was never inappropriate.
No,
and while, you know, like I said, like we've said before, where the best music in movies will enhance rather mm-hmm. than detract, it definitely doesn't distract from anything going on the screen, but it does give you, you know, those moments where the film breathes and the score takes over mm-hmm. and takes you to that next level of emotion. Mm-hmm. So it definitely enhances it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unexpected. Like some of the moments, like sometimes I was sitting there and I was caught off guard by the type of music that was evoking, you know, this type of thing, or it didn't yeah. necessarily wasn't the first thing that I would have thought to put down for this type of a scene, mm-hmm. but it just worked. There's something about it that just worked.
They've done a great job of creating a feel now for the series. Like we saw, you know, like we've talked about before how like the first movie is just kind of like, this is a hodgepodge of a lot of different things going on.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a good film, good story, but you know, right. not necessarily well executed. Catching Fire kind of started over and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And this is a maturing of that story, both visually, with the imagery and the way in which it is, shot, with the music, character development. Like I really,
even the acting, I definitely think everybody was like spot on this time too.
I mean, and that a lot of that, you know, is due in part to Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like he was a highlight of Catching Fire. He
right.
is another huge highlight. Like he lends gravity to a lot of these scenes. It'll be interesting to see how we move into the last movie because of his death, how they're able to use his character, how much of it actually got filmed. We don't know. We know it was key scenes that were missing and that they're having to replace and put him into
CG and
yeah,
whatever.
Like just I mean, there were some scenes whenever it was kind of like, you know, it was okay. And then all of a sudden he speaks up and it's like, yeah, like, yes.
For sure. I think early on in the series, and even in Catching Fire a little bit, Haymitch's character, like the way that they, I think the casting done on him wasn't quite what I ever imagined him being in the books. And so like that was the very first thing. He looked too clean in the first movie. But then as progressively as they've gone with these characters, this one, he nailed it. Like even Catching Fire, like early on or whatever, there was a few lines where I was just like, eh, you know, but on this one, there wasn't a single line, I don't think, that I was, you know, brought out of it at all.
I love Woody Harrelson. He does a phenomenal job. And let's talk about the actors for a second. You know, we had Julianne Moore did a great job as President Coyne.
Yeah.
You know, as always, Donald Sutherland did a great job as President Snow.
Yep.
Jennifer Lawrence, phenomenal job. Josh Hutchinson and who plays Gale?
Oh, it's what's his name's brother?
Yes.
Oh man.
Hemsworth.
Yes. Liam Hemsworth.
Yep. They both did great job. Like better jobs than they have done in past movies.
Yes.
And so I was really impressed with the acting.
Oh yeah, man. As far as some of those strange like visuals and that sort of thing, CG, there was only one standout to me that looked CG in the thing, but yeah, other than that, all of the visuals were just spot on.
Yeah, like I said, you know, the world building, they've done a great job, like with, you know, the locations that they pick, with, you know, the imagery for, you know, the capital and all the districts. I love how they all have a different feel and a different look, and the costume design, they're all different, you know, like they've done a great job with this stuff. And it really feels like a real place now. Like it feels like this is like some kind of post-apocalyptic America that I could visit, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So are we ready to spoil, Chris?
I'm ready to spoil. So definitely go see this movie.
Absolutely go see this movie.
Watch the other ones first. But yeah, if you know, you're a fan of The Hunger Games, go see this movie. Like, you will not be disappointed.
Absolutely.
I promise.
So the spoiler clock is going down. So if you haven't seen this film yet, turn it off, please. And 3, 2, 1, throw out a spoiler. Deer in the headlights, look over there, dude.
The cat's alive.
Ooh, that was a good one.
I guess I could have gone with they don't end with the fight at the mountain, which I thought they were gonna do.
So that was a big deal to me. Like it was kind of one of those situations where it's like dragging on. I'm like, when are we gonna get to the mountain fight? But that made sense. It made sense from where they started. And whenever you think about kind of what started everything, what triggered this movie, like the action moving forward, it was her seeing PETA for the first time on the screens.
Yeah.
Because before that, she was kind of like wishy-washy about what she wanted to do. And even though she had gone and seen and gone to see this, gone to see District 12 and had that emotional, you know, thing, she still really didn't know what she was going to do until she saw PETA, and she was like, no, I need to get this. And so like to get him back finally at the end was the correct resolution to that story, that side story.
Right. Well, and I thought after we had left, I was like, you know, okay, I thought they were going to end with the mountain, but I'm glad that they didn't, because honestly, that's the beginning of the fight, you know, final fight. And that's what the last is going to be. The other thing is, like, I don't know that it would have emotionally felt as satisfying. Like, as much as what didn't happen in this film yet, you know, like, it still felt really emotionally satisfying, like, and shocking as well. Like, it didn't necessarily, right. Emotionally satisfying doesn't mean it ended in a good place. It ended in a very, very strange, very weird, dangerous place almost.
Right.
But it still felt right. You know, like, this is where we should be at the end of this story arc.
Right. And it felt very Luke's got his hand cut off
and Darth Vader's his father.
Yeah. So it's like it definitely felt like that type of an ending.
Yeah.
So at the end of this movie, like we end it with this big twist of PETA is, you know, he's can't handle where he's at, can't handle being around her. This thing that she sought to get back is ruined right now. So.
Yeah. Well, something I'm glad that they did, you know, like we talked about, we don't know how moving forward, how they were going to deal with the fact how that Katniss is just bat crazy in the last book. Like, and almost, like, honestly, to the point where you don't like her. You don't like her as a character anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you were like, you are stupid.
Yeah.
Stop it. You know, like.
Well, it's like she's been through so much. And because in the book, you're in her brain. And you see all of the indecision. You see all of the small things where, you know, she, if she doesn't like a certain character for one thing or whatever,
yeah,
it's in there.
Yeah.
And so it's that internal dialogue of someone who has been broken over so much trauma. And so to be inside that, you can't relate to it as a reader unless you've experienced that trauma, which you haven't. You've only read about it. And so it very realistically portrays like what she would have generally been like.
Kind of, you know, like, you know, you have this very, my biggest problem with that has always been with the book, and the way that she's portrayed in the book is like you have this very broken person on the inside, but yet she's able to do things that a person that's broken in that way could not necessarily do. She's like, you know, gather up this courage to. Basically take down the Capitol. Like, you know, like her mindset and the things that she does have always been at odds in the way that she's portrayed in the book.
Right.
This feels a lot more natural and feels like, okay, this is how, like, you understand that, yes, she's had this trauma, you know, like, but she's able to get past it. In the book, she's never able to get past it. This it keeps happening, but she's able to overcome it every single time, and you see her overcome it every single time,
right?
And I really
like that. Yeah,
I love this portrayal. I think this is more honest and more true to real life.
You know, if you look at the book and look at kind of the from book one all the way through book three. She's got those. She's consistently inconsistent between her emotions yes. and what she does, because it's the whole situation of I don't really like this guy, but I'm putting on this cover.
I'm gonna kiss him anyway,
right? And play with his emotions anyway. And so it's like it's always that in the book, and so like that's a through line through all the books. But you can't really do that in the films, and I think that's part of the reason why they failed in my mind on the first movie in that way to have a big payoff is that they. Tried.
Yeah.
They tried to show you the inconsistencies between her emotions and what the portrayal is on the outside.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work. It didn't ring as true to look at it that way.
Right.
Unless you're in somebody's mind, it wouldn't ring true. But in the second movie, they decided, hey, we're gonna change this. We're not gonna you know screw with all of that conflict inside. We're gonna focus on more of the external and making these big. Terrible decisions that she has to make and making those the struggle.
Yeah.
And so then they continued that with this one. And honestly, it's a different character. It's a
right.
completely different person than is in the books. And I like it. It's like you said, it feels more true on screen.
They also give her a clear motivation for why she does what she does.
Right.
You know, like, whereas in the book, it's always like, why is she making this decision? And like, she's always so insecure about it.
Yeah.
You know, her motivations are clear in each, and they make them clear in each scene in this movie, you know?
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a second. You know, like, I really love the emotional payoffs in this movie, you know, like the emotional beats. You have, you know, the firebombing of, she sees the fire, like the results of the firebombing of District 12.
Right.
You see how the look on her face and how she reacts to the people in the hospital.
Yeah.
Which
honestly, that particular scene might have been the only direct conflict, like war situation that they really put her in, where she's drawn her bow or anything.
Yeah.
She only really shot one arrow, but it was a good arrow.
I think that shows how strong this movie was in the fact that we had none of like the action sequences that we've had before in the other two movies.
Right.
And it was still as compelling.
Yeah. And that's interesting because in the last half of this movie or of this series, like the part two is going to be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that the last half of Catching Fire was just crazy.
Yeah.
But we're going to have time in between to really digest what's happened here and have a clear vision for what we do, you know, moving forward.
Yeah.
The another emotional beat that I loved was whenever the bombings happened and they go down into the basement and they lock all the doors. And while, you know, that was almost verbatim what happened in the book, it was nice to actually see the portrayal and just to see, you know, all of the people, to see her get kind of almost trampled to death there down the steps. And to the just the bombing sounds was just shocking and frightening.
That's something I was gonna mention. And whenever we were talking about music, you know, there were several times we'll talk about it in a second where the music like was added and it added an extra layer to the scene. That was whenever it like it completely emptied out almost, and all you're hearing is the bombing,
just the sound design, dude.
And it was frightening. You know, like you felt like you are inside this bunker with them. The parts where it was added whenever she was singing that song, and then it moves into that the I guess what district was that?
The one with the dam.
Yeah, it said.
I don't remember.
I don't know.
It was District 3 or District 2? No,
I think it was 3. You're
it was
right.
Because 2 is the one we're about to go to with the big mountain.
Correct.
And 3 is the
It was either 3 or 6. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Anyway, the way that the music played with that scene was amazing, you know, where it goes from just her singing to the entire group singing and what they're doing.
And that played emotional, like that was an action scene per se, but it played an emotional beat because it took this entirely small, minute action that she made and it blew up on this big global, like this, she is the reason that they're going, or like the thing that they're using to hold on to as they basically do this suicide mission attack against the Capitol.
Yeah.
And so it shows like how small of an action, something that she does that's not even intentional can turn into something that is just global.
It was a magnificent portrayal of, yes, how powerful she is as a symbol, but also the effect that the promos that she was doing had on the populace without even having to see the promo in that moment. You know, you just switch from her singing to the end result of this.
Right.
Great job portraying that without being really overt about it, showing people watch it and then like, hey, let's go take out the dam.
Right. Heavy handed or anything.
Yeah.
Something else that's interesting about this particular movie and this story is that they use the whole propaganda thing. Like they show how propaganda is used in war.
Yeah.
And they show how the two sides, polarizing sides, use it, it to two different, completely different effects. And so like, I always enjoyed that aspect of this story just in general, because you don't see that very often. Even if you watch a World War II movie or if you watch, you know, something that is about a war, you don't really see that side of it, but that's been so, ingrained in the DNA of the Hunger Games from the first movie or first book that it had to be there.
Yeah.
It had to be there whenever you have an overt war situation, that it's been used so much to control people that, of course, both sides are going to have to use it to their benefit.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk at length, you know, and how the media is portrayed and mass communication is portrayed in these movies. And it's true to real life. It's real. And, you know, we think, you know, we get so bombarded and inundated with so many messages on a daily basis from all forms of media that I think we kind of disassociate from it.
Right.
It's not like it was whenever, like, hey, you have like 3 stations on your television, you watch them. Well, this is 1 station on your television, you have to watch that. So, like, if as much as we pay attention to Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all this kind of stuff, if all that was like condensed down into one form of communication
and one source, and now 2,
it's effective. You know, it's an effective way to spread an idea.
Right,
is through this kind of propaganda.
It's interesting. You mentioned the 3. I watched Days of Future Past again over the weekend, and they at the one point in that movie, he says, he's like, I have this room rigged to record all 3 networks and PBS.
Yes.
And he goes, all 3, and he says, and PBS. Yes. And it's this room of equipment, just tapes rolling the whole time.
Now my box can record 6 all at once.
Yeah, dude, just a tiny little chip, you know, whatever. Yeah. on demand.
Another thing, like you mentioned World War II, like this movie especially, some of the scenes I love the most were like when they took out the dam, whenever the people ran up into the trees and blew up all the peacekeepers down below.
Dude,
like,
and
it reminds me of World War II. Like this is the kind of stuff that would happen, you know, and like whenever,
Poland and that.
Yeah, whenever like the underground would basically take out these Nazi plans or Russian plans to, you know, wipe out these people or something like that, you know, like,
dude. And it's interesting to see how the disparity of economics in this world mm-hmm. can lend itself. You have this very futuristic tanks. You see the rooms full of missiles mm-hmm. that the rebels, quote unquote, have in District 13, but then they're doing these guerrilla tactics mm-hmm. and these very, ground level type insurgencies. On the Capitol because of the whole disparity of wealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's always fun to root for the underdog. It's also always fun to see like how resourceful human beings can be against a superior force.
Something that I loved about that particular scene where they kind of climb up into the trees and they blow everything up is that it showed the. It showed the casualties on both sides, like mm-hmm. where initially it's like these people, they knew that there was very slim chances mm-hmm. for them to do it, but they knew somebody would do it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see in that. And then also on the dam, like where you yeah. have all these people just rushing, you know, like I said, the suicide mission to destroy the dam. Mm-hmm. And it's weird to see that portrayed on screen. In such a realistic way, like it's
in this kind of a movie.
In this kind of a movie, yeah, because you usually are a step away from that.
Yeah.
You're usually like we were during the bombing. You're usually in the bunker with the leaders, yeah. and the leaders are telling each other, "Oh, we're gonna send troops this way and send troops this way or whatever." And in this time, you see kind of these ground level type of attacks, and that's nice to see in a movie like this. It doesn't take very long to do that, mm-hmm. And it adds to the emotional stakes.
Yeah,
you know, it says, "Hey, these people are oppressed enough to do this," mm-hmm. and so that's what's at stake.
Well, I think there was a good line from President Coyne, you know, during one of those sequences or after, you know, she said, "No success is won without sacrifice."
Yeah,
and like. They portrayed that very well, you know, like, and everyone's sacrificing on all levels at this point, you know, like, and it's a good balanced look at the way the Capitol is working, you know, so like President Snow, his approach is to, he's basically sacrificing, PETA and, the other two, not tributes,
yes,
I guess
tributes.
They're called tributes. Victors.
Yeah, that's right.
So the other two, so that they're sacrificing the victors, you know, like yep. that's what they're doing.
Well, they're also sacrificing
and the people.
Yeah. They're also sacrificing their guard. You know, the people who are, you know, getting blown up by the people climbing the trees and the people at the dam and things.
I mean, kind of, like, but they're more like, you know, you think about like the atrocities that they're committing against their own people. So like they're
it's
supposed
true.
To protect these people.
That's true.
But they bomb this hospital, you know, just for a show of power.
Right.
You know, they are torturing the victors just to get their way, you know, like
right.
There's a good balance against the way that, you know, the rebels are working. Like they're not torturing Katniss in order to get her to do what they want. You know, like there is a difference in the way that they are going about this.
There is. And then there was also this underlying unsettledness about some of the ways that Coyne's speeches would go.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would after the hospital was bombed out or whatever, it was what's his name? Finnick, who leans over and says to Katniss as they're all chanting and stuff, he says it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like bringing a war chant to a funeral or something
yeah.
like that, a victory chant to a funeral or something yeah. like that. And it's very much feels like that. And you have this unsettled feeling towards her in particular, towards the president in particular, mm-hmm. because she's so disconnected.
Yeah.
And while they aren't forcing anybody to do anything, while they aren't making these, basically committing war crimes.
Right.
They're not committing crimes against humanity. They are. They do have this disconnect from the people who are actually fighting
yeah.
right now.
Because
they're sitting there with all of their warheads, you know, in their bunkers.
And it can be argued, you know, like, I mean, how much, you know, what mindset is the right mindset as a leader in that time? You know, like, do you take a whole long time and mourn, or do you realize, hey, this was actually a strategic victory for us, despite the fact that we lost people, is turning more, even more people against the Capitol, you know, and
I think that was what Finnick's point was. He said, just focus on the good we did, you mm-hmm. know, so.
Yeah, I mean, but long and short of it is they did do a promo, like, in the midst of this tragedy, and they used, you know, they're using a tragedy for their own gain. You know, they're kind of politicizing this event. Yeah.
It was weird to see the same scene of the hospital and that speech that she gives to two different soundtracks. Because first you have this emotional soundtrack that makes you, like, brings tears to your eyes and, you know, all this stuff. And then you see it as a propaganda piece uh-huh. with this victorious music behind yeah. it. And, you know, and then the whole join the fight yeah. comes on. It feels like a movie trailer.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, like, illustrates, okay, how we've turned this thing that did feel right and did feel good into this thing. It's like, man, you know, what is this doing? But then right. you look at the results, yeah. you know, and how it's spurring on the other districts to rebel. And you're like, well, you can't argue with the results.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that all comes down to, you know, that end goal of they want to free these people. They want the democracy. You know, or at least that's what Coin says and things. And so you have that as the end goal. You wanted these people need this. These people want this. If you trace down to the core of their beings, they are oppressed and mm-hmm. they are being trodden upon, and so they need to be freed. And so that, you know, it's serving the purpose there. So yeah,
yeah. I really I enjoyed seeing them mess up and try to get her to perform well in that first promo. That was really well done.
For sure.
I liked the way that they incorporated the director and her cameraman and yeah. that.
The director did an incredible job. That actress did a really good job portraying that character to be this almost this really relatable character to begin with, like where you want her to be friends with Katniss.
Right.
But then as the pressure kind of builds, you see the director develop a little bit and change into kind of a little bit more forceful there near the end. Whenever she's standing there with the flowers, you know, she gets a little bit in Katniss's face about yeah. it. And so you kind of have that development going. So I like how this side character who could have just been just a side plot or whatever mm-hmm. actually did change from the moment we met her till whenever we left her. So.
Yeah. Natalie Dahmer, does a great job. I like, you know, she's on Game of Thrones. I really enjoy her there. Does a great job. The, you know, in the book, she's not necessarily a confidant to Katniss, but she speaks into her life on several occasions. And while we didn't necessarily see that happen, we felt that happen, you know what I mean? In the way that she would coach her and the results, like it never felt, her character doesn't feel disingenuous in any way.
Right.
And she's not supposed to.
No, like, not at all.
But she very well could have, you know, like it could have come across as like, oh, this is the director trying to.
She's a minder for
trying
Katniss.
To get the good shot, you know, and right. you know, that kind of stuff. But it really feels like she's being intellectually honest with the how she's directing and producing these pieces.
But also has that second mind about her where she can, you know, nudge what's his name and go, this is good stuff. You need, yeah. you need to be getting this. Well, you know?
There is an art to saying, okay, yeah, this is interesting stuff. You know, like you watch the evening news. Let's watch the evening news, for instance. You know, how much of that is actually captivating material? You know, Anchorman pokes fun at it whenever, you know, you have someone go, you know, look at a story about a cat fashion show, you know?
Right.
How much of that is actually captivating? But there are parts of real life that are, and, right. it, and it takes a talented person to recognize that. And,
right.
She does.
Yeah.
And they portray that very well.
Yeah.
You know? So
I definitely think they have that tasteful director kind of thing down because it does, like you said, it never comes across as like, you know, she's shallow or she's whatever. It comes across as, you know, this is intriguing. I'm intrigued by this. Other people need to see this too.
Yeah.
You know, that type of situation.
What's, you know, I think in this movie, at least, she's probably the character that, you know, whenever she says, you know, we came here and left the Capitol because we believed in the cause, because we came here for you.
I
think her and Gale are the two characters that honestly you feel the most belief in this cause from, in terms of the main characters, you know, like
yes.
you always kind of question, like, you know, for Coin, I think there's some kind of like, it feels like a power grab.
Yeah.
Even for Plutarch.
Like I said, you're still unsettled about everything about Coin still.
it feels like a power grab for her. For Plutarch, it feels like this is, you know, like a political game.
Or like, hey, I'm getting back at the people that burned me, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I don't really feel that. But, like, it's just all a game for him. Like, this has all been a game. Even the games were a game. You know what I mean?
The games were a game?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of how he has played people and how he politically maneuvers things around.
Yeah.
Katniss, you know, just, you know, like, she's in the middle of this, didn't necessarily ask for it. She said that several times. And, you know, she doesn't really, it's not that she doesn't care how this turns out. It's like, she honestly, what's different about this now is, like, in the book, you really feel like she doesn't care how this turns out.
Right.
She just wants to get through it.
Right.
Alive.
Yeah.
And she wants Peeta to be okay and Prim to be okay.
Right.
Everyone else doesn't matter. And this, though, it does feel like she does have vested interest in the cause, especially like whenever she talks to President Snow, whenever she decides, you know, like obviously they're going in to get in Peeta out of the
right
the building, the torture chamber. But like whenever she's having this conversation with Snow, she basically says, "Why? Why is this? Why I didn't ask for this? Like, tell me what to do to make this okay."
Right.
You know, I'm not all in this, but just tell me what to do to get out of this.
Right.
Know?
And then he kind of lays it out. Like, I love the idea that he lays it out to where that is, you know, you've been sucked into this. That's it. You know, in his mind, this was going to happen no matter what.
Well, in his mind, and then he does make a good point. You know, it's her own fault. You know, like she says and feels like she's been sucked into this, but she has made definite decisions along the way. Like, you know, that were of her own volition.
Yeah. And, but I mean, honestly, the ones during the games, it's like he's the one who put her in those positions, or the system rather is the one that put her in that position to make those decisions. And there was no better, you know, decision to make at the time, because you can't argue with the fact that the people that she loves, the majority of them have made it to this point, you know? So it's like, obviously she's made the right call most of the time up until now.
Yeah. Considering what her motivation is. Yeah. She's accomplished what she's meant, you know, trying to do.
Right.
But
it is the goal of, hey, I want not only myself to live, other people, that has got her there. You're correct. Like, right. That, well, that is kind of on her.
So, like, you know, the choices that she's made, you know, like if it's like saying, you know, like the circumstances are what, you know, put her into this position or got her into this position. Not really, right. Because if that was the case, then anyone could have been her. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not the case. Like, she is the one who made the decisions to get to this point, to be the Mockingjay, to rebel against, you know, try to get, you know, there's two victors. And even in the first book, in the first games, right. There's only supposed to be one victor. There's two because of the way she manipulated the system.
Right.
In the second movie, and like, they got out of the dome by the way that she manipulated the system and you know, destroyed basically the dome whenever it was electrocuted. You
right.
know, it's like there were things that only she would have done because of the person that she is and choices that she's made
right.
that do make it there. She has played more of an active role than she is admitting
right.
in becoming the Mockingjay.
Yeah, but you still sort of feel sucked in because it's like because of the fact that, you know, again, with your end goal, it's like, man, this is the best case so far, but you've caused a war now. You know, it's almost that personal sacrifice versus like global sacrifice. You know, it's like she's saying, I don't really buy into the whole, you know, causing a war situation. I don't want all of this. I don't want there to be war. But there's like two sides to a war, and mm-hmm. if one person wants to lay their guns down and like be done, they can. Which is the irony of what Peeta was saying to the rebels, quote unquote, is he was saying that you guys should just lay down your guns and this will all be over. But really, it's the same could be said about the Capitol. They could mm-hmm. just lay down their guns and this would be over.
True,
there are both sides of this. You know? And I loved that aspect of the movie as well, because you have this whenever they're bombing the District 13, Coin says to someone, prepare the warheads, you know, target the Capitol, prepare the warheads. And so it's like this mutually assured destruction vibe that you get as well, mm-hmm. where it's like they could just pull the plug on humanity altogether.
Yeah. I mean, that's not the point. Like, you know, that's not necessarily Coin's end goal, though. Like,
no.
You know.
Obviously, she didn't shoot him, but.
Right. And so, like, I think that mindset is there. And, like, okay, well, if they're going to kill all of us, then we're just going to kill all of them and nobody wins, you know? nobody gets the toy.
Yeah. It's the Cold War, man.
You know, going back to, though, to like, you know, we talked about Katniss has these end goals, and they're more clearly defined in the movies than they were in the book. She's achieved those goals. She's kept the people that she loves safe. That's always been her goal so far. Safe, relatively safe. PETA's not dead. He wasn't safe, but and so, but like both sides, both President Snow and President Coyne have co-opted Katniss's goals and use them for their own devices, you know, right. Like for both sides, you know, like for to become a symbol for the rebellion, and then Snow's used it as an excuse to wipe out District 12, you right. know, like, and so things that she didn't necessarily mean to have such an impact are having these huge impacts, and I think she's starting to realize that. She realizes it more in the book than she does than she is right now, but then again, her goals are more defined, so I don't know. Like, you know, you can look over a lot of things like that whenever you have a specific goal
whenever
in mind.
Whenever it's clear, yeah. And it's interesting because there is that through line. Like you said, these small things that she's done, like saying, hey, I want to protect these people, and it basically gives people tools to manipulate her. It's you said yes. that small things that she does turns into large things later on. I mean, small things that she does, like in the first book, mm-hmm. it's turned into a war. And then the small thing, again, with the song this time, turned into basically a war cry, you mm-hmm. know. It's interesting. I love it.
Yeah, I like it a lot too. Another thing I wanted to mention was, like, I really love the technology in this.
Yeah.
Whenever they're at the end, they're flying that. What do they call the airplanes?
I don't remember.
I don't know. Hovercraft. Yeah, hovercraft into the city, and which is eerily creepy. With no power on.
Dude, so somebody tweeted out, it reminded me of, somebody tweeted a photo of what New York would look like with no power, with no light pollution is what they called it. And it was ridiculous. You could see the sky. And this reminded me very much of what that, like, that artist's representation looked like.
That's
it was
wild.
Nuts.
Yeah, and so I love that. I love the being able to see the buildings, you know, like on the hovercraft's window. I still really love all the technology in this world. Like, it's different than, like, whenever Haymitch goes up and wipes his arm on the touchscreen, and it, like, erases things that are there, you know, like, but they look like documents is the thing. But
right.
And then he writes on it, and it's basically creating documents as you're writing on this board. Like, that's crazy cool.
It's cool. And then also, for a second there, I thought we were in like this Bond film whenever they're rappelling into the into the tribute center or whatever. Yeah. Dude, that was nuts. And it excites me for the second half of this because of all the action. So it excites me. All of the action we saw, while it was very small and very not the focus of this film, it was very well done and very well framed with these kind of unique looking shots that excite me just by, like, looking at them.
Yeah.
And add a level of tension just by the way that they're framed and stuff. So I'm excited to see that move forward as well. But I love this fact that, like, in the jet, they would have the outlines of the different towers, and then it also, like, mapped out which building it was, pointed at it, that sort of thing. That was really cool.
You mentioned, you kind of touched on, you know, the cinematography. I really liked the cinematography in this. I liked, you know, the colors that they would use, you know, like the red whenever they're going through the building and things like that. I enjoyed a lot of the cool close-up shots with lots of depth of field. I will say the one thing I didn't like, where there were some handheld shots whenever they were in the district with the hospital, that were just, like, crazy and way out of place. Like, you saw them twice whenever they're, like, the camera guys are running behind them, and two shots that just, like, don't match anything else in the rest of the movie. And it wasn't a violent or action packed enough moment.
It was like we're climbing the stairs.
Exactly.
I remember the exact, like, one, dude.
Why do we have such a crazy handheld camera right
Chris,
here?
Chris, you got to get the excitement when you can have it.
Apparently,
running up the stairs can be very exciting. Very exciting. And there was one other shot where, like, they zoomed in. It was the same sort of thing of whenever they first enter the hospital, and we're following her in, and it, like, zooms in a little bit, and I was like, what in the world?
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was just kind of jarred me. I didn't really think about it until now that you mention it, but yeah, those did seem kind of out of place. Whenever the guys were down, like, the cinematography, like you mentioned colors, I liked the whiteout of whenever they were to get PETA, and they threw in the smoke, and then the lights come back on, and because you think you're in this really dirty kind of lab kind of place, you expect it to, like, turn on, and it's, like, green or, like, yellow or something, and it looked like a vet's office or something, but it turned turns on and it's this pristine room, and it shows this just bright white fog of cleanliness, and it's really just disturbing in some like unsettling weird way, that because every other time you see the Capitol, you see this lavish bright colors and you see all this stuff, but in this room that we hide from everyone it's just white.
This is very sterile.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
no
really,
character.
That was really cool as well. And visually, like this, what are they called? Like District 13, they call this bunker something in the book, and they never said it in the movie.
You remember
what I'm talking about?
I do remember they called it something, but I don't remember.
Anyway, like it really, it looks exactly like I thought it did. You know, like with the way that you go down, you look up, and it's just this huge tube.
Like silo.
Yeah, silo kind of thing. Like, that was really cool. You know, that's something that, at least since the last movie, since Catching Fire, that they've done really well, is, like, really get good representations of the way that I thought things looked in the book whenever I read them.
Yeah.
And turning them into real life.
Definitely. I did miss Cinna a little bit, but I think, like, you mentioned the director to these things kind of becoming a little bit of a confidant. I mean, not necessarily on a huge level, not on the level that Cinna was, but I think that her presence made the impact of Cinna not being in this, it kind of lessened that.
Yeah.
Because he was always this kind of almost nudging her.
He's a believer.
He was a believer, and he was nudging her in that direction. He never really explicitly told her, you know, hey, you should do this or whatever. He left it up to her, but he was kind of always kind of nudging her in that direction. I did miss him a little bit. But just as far as that goes, his story, you know, it was told, and it continues now. His legacy continues through her outfit.
Yeah. I liked the call. That's what I was going to say. I liked the callback to it, to him, and specifically, and how much, like, he believed in her so much that he designed an outfit that he didn't even know would actually be used, you know?
Right.
He hoped and believed that it would, and believed that they would get to this point, but, you know, he's dead now, so he, you know, didn't get to see it come to fruition. And so, yeah, there was kind of in that moment, you kind of feel like, okay, well, we're doing this for Cinna in some way, you know, like to honor his memory.
And it's nice that the outfit that he chose was functional as well. That it's very much an armor based thing. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, got some armor on it. It's mobility based. Mm-hmm. And so it's very functional, despite the fact that it looks really cool. You can tell he knew that this wouldn't just be used for the promos or
he's
whatever.
He's a fashion designer.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's like, but he had this functionality to it.
Yeah.
He always kind of had that in there. I like that they continued that on here. She looked awesome in that.
Oh, yeah.
So
the armor looked amazing.
So cool, dude.
Yeah, like, and honestly, I never thought about it before, but you could almost think of Cinna as the first casualty of this war.
It's true. I mean, the first meaningful one other than Rue, maybe Rue would be just a collateral damage almost because she was in the games to begin with.
Yeah, I don't really include the deaths in the games necessarily because those would have happened.
Or even in the first movie.
Those would have happened in the course of the games anyway, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this was the one who he died for the cause, because he helped her and believed in the rebellion in that way, he died, you know?
Right. And it's weird that you never saw his death, that you just see him get dragged away or whatever, but it's, you know, it's, I guess that's how life is sometimes, you know, you don't get the, you don't get to say goodbye or you don't get the payoff that you look for. So,
right.
Well, that's pretty much it. Do you want to give this thing a rating?
Yes.
That's all I've got. So let's rate this thing. How do you rate this?
I'm going to rate this an 8.5.
That's exactly what I was going to go for. The only criticism that I really have, and the only thing that I would lean more towards like the eights as opposed to the nines, is because it just doesn't, like, it's the first half of a story. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have that big epic ending that we were looking for. It has a lot of emotional impact, but it definitely does feel like it's the first half of something.
Mm-hmm.
I would never, you know, close the book at this point and say, this is done.
No.
Genuinely done.
No.
You know? So, yeah, that's the only really downside I have about it.
But, yeah. You know? I agree. That's the exact same reason for me, just because, like, you know, it is emotionally satisfying, and that's why I do love these movies, you know, like the first half of Harry Potter and the first half of this one, you know, like, because they do provide an emotional experience that you don't get in standalone movies.
Correct.
You know, or in the first and last half of them.
And world building, especially. Like, you don't really understand what's going on, in very like single part movies, mm-hmm. you know?
And so like, that's why I love it. But you know, like in order to have a satisfying, you know, story arc between, you know, the beginning, middle and end of the movie, like,
it needs a definitely resolution to where we started at the beginning of this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll maybe revisit that whenever the second part comes out. Maybe it would maybe nod this one up a little bit, you know, if you view them as one story or one movie, you yeah. know, that'd be a weird podcast episode. Like maybe we should put that on there somewhere, maybe for next November movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds good. Well, that's it for this week. You can find us online at stayontargetpodcast.com, on Twitter at ChrisWright250
and JohnWright777
and at StayOnTargetPod. Next week we will continue finish out November movie month.
Yes, we're wrapping it up, man.
So stay tuned for that. We also have the Arrow podcast, the Flash podcast. You can find that on iTunes or on our website. We review each episode of The Flash, CW's The Flash, and Arrow every single week.
We've also got some exciting things planned for December in the form of potentially some buyer's guides.
Yeah, we've got some buyer's guides. We've also got our Hobbit, The Battle of Five Armies review. So next month is going to be a lot of fun as well.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for now. We'll see you next week on
Stay on Target.